Hello, listeners and students of Hitler's Table Talk. We're bringing you episode 28 of Adolf Hitler's Lunch and Dinner Table Monologues between 1941 and 1944, as taken down in shorthand as a record of Hitler's genius, the project being instigated by his secretary, Martin Bormann. Hitler's Table Talk was first published in the 1950s, yet many people are still unaware of it, and I myself had not read it until now. I'm one of your hosts, Carolyn Yeager, and
I'm one of your other hosts, Ray Goodwin.
We're going to begin tonight at the end of February 1942, isn't that right, Ray?
That's correct.
We have an interesting number of segments here tonight, don't
Topic.
We?
Topic, that's right, yeah, okay. The night of the 22nd and 23rd of February 1942, headlines are the principal newspapers of the party, Tristan and other pieces at Vienna. The organization of our press has truly been a success. Our law concerning the press is such that divergences of opinion between members of the government are no longer an occasion for public exhibitions, which are not the newspaper's business. We've eliminated that conception of political freedom, according to which everybody has the right to say whatever comes into his head. Amon controls more than half of the German press. It's enough for me to send for Lorenz and inform him of my point of view, and I know that next day all the German newspapers will broadcast my ideas. Our little Dr. Dietrich is an extremely clever man. He doesn't write well, but his speeches are often first rate. I'm proud to be able to think that with such collaborators at my side, I can make a sheer about turn, as I did on the 22nd of June last year, without anyone's moving a muscle. And that's a thing that's possible in no country but ours.
Our illustrated. Let me break in here,
yeah.
Ray, because I was looking up Dietrich to see. I thought it must be Otto Dietrich, and that's who. Otto Dietrich was the third press secretary for the Third Reich. And he's both called an intimate of, I don't think the word was intimate, but anyway, close to Hitler, and Hitler had a lot of confidence in him, as he's expressing here. But then later on, Hitler fired him for some kind of mistake he made. But it was said that he didn't, truthfully, was not an insider, and he didn't always know what was going on with Hitler. So, and then he wrote a book and said that, a critical book, I was just reading about it, more critical than most of the people that were close to Hitler, you know, over the years,
right.
Ever wrote. So that's kind of interesting. I'd like to find out more about that. But yeah, he calls him our little Dr. Dietrich, and I thought, you know, was he short? And I saw one picture where he looked real little, but then he was standing a few steps down from Hitler. So,
yeah.
But he does look like he's not a very big man. So it's kind of interesting that Hitler says our little Dr. Dietrich. Kind of, but not. I wouldn't want to be called that way if I was a man. But that's who he's talking about, and he is certainly bragging though about the media that they have.
Right.
And he's, satisfied with it, yeah. I think they're doing really well. Well, go ahead.
And it carries on into, he says, our illustrated newspapers have greatly improved, but to compete abroad with the Anglo-Saxon weeklies, the Leipziger Illustrierte should be more eye-catching. The Berliner, the Münchener, and the Wiener are well-made illustrated papers. The JB still better. The Kölner gained the limelight some years ago thanks to the documents it published. On the other hand, we could easily do without the Deutsche Illustrierte. Das Reich is a great success. When peace has returned, we shall need, as a pendant to Das Reich, a Sunday weekly for people in the country. It should be easy to read, should have a serialized novel so that young girls should likewise get their share, and should be copiously illustrated. The English newspapers are in a privileged position as regards both the text and the photographic documentation. from all parts of the world, their material reaches them in floods. We ourselves shall be enabled by our new conquest to make progress in that field. The brilliance and what's called the charm of Vienna are explained by a long past. For five centuries, Vienna was the capital of an empire. I was so poor during the Viennese period of my life that I had to restrict myself to seeing only the finest spectacles. Thus, I heard Tristan 30 or 40 times, and always from the best companies. I also heard some Verdi and other works, leaving out the small fry.
Well, there's stuff left out of this, but whenever he starts talking about opera or whatever, the note taker includes it, seems like. I don't think you just all of a sudden get on to say those things out of the blue without any thing kind of leading into it. But and then again, once again, we don't have what other people say, so that's good to have played a part there. But I really like this. I think it says a lot about him and his thoughtfulness, even though it sounds like a little bit of a put-down, but I don't see it that way, where he says that in the Sunday papers for the people in the country, it should be easy to read and it should have a novel so that young girls could likewise get their share.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, knowing, and it's true that that's what girls like, you know, some novel of that, you know, tells them about life outside of the country where they live, you know, the countryside and so on. And he's thinking about everybody. That's the way I take that. I think it's kind of sweet.
Well, I think you're exactly correct, and I'm glad to hear you say that, because that was what I had marked in that section that I would comment on a bit. You've said it quite well. But to me, it was a reaching out, or let's don't forget the common folks. We don't want to print a paper that's strictly business and history about everything. Let's make it illustrated well. Let's make it entertaining. And I also thought about that comment about so that young girls could likewise get their share. Let's put a serialized novel, and how the idiots in this country today would jump all over that as sexist or whatever you want to call it, as patronizing or whatever. But I agree. I think it was a very, very well thought out idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, he was a good guy. He had a lot on his plate, but he thought about everything.
Sure. 24th of February, 1942, midday. How great artists can serve their country. I've learned that young Roller has just fallen at the front. If I'd known that he had gone out, but nobody told me. There are hundreds of thousands of men who could serve their country in no better way than by risking their lives for her, but a great artist should find another way. Can fate allow it that the most idiotic Russian should strike down men like that? We have so many men seconded for special duties. What harm could it do to add to their number the 500 or 600 gifted men whom it would be important to save? Roller is irreplaceable. We had only Sievert, Arendt, and Pretorius. Austria had given us the young Roller. Why didn't Chirac warn me? I saw his Friedenstock. What a lovely thing. The young Roller was a brave man. Before the Anschluss, he would have had to leave Austria. I'm convinced he went out as a volunteer. I could have sent him anywhere at all for personal reasons if he hadn't insisted on staying in Vienna. So he's talking about the loss of someone who meant something to him.
Well, yeah, and I was trying to figure out who. And it's a little bit mysterious to me. I did find a Austrian painter, graphic designer, and set designer who was quite famous that he would have thought highly of, Alfred Roller. But he died, and he was Austrian, as I said, but he died in 1935. And according to his biography, and this is February 1942, so I thought it must be his son. But I couldn't find anything on another, and I think it's pronounced Roller.
Roller.
I just still wondering, but now he's saying that he saw his Friedenstock. Well, that almost sounds like the father, because that could have been a play, and he would have done the set designs, you know. Hitler was really big on set designs because he liked opera and theater so much. So he paid attention to that and to all those people who did it. So I just can't quite figure out, but sure he's not confused.
I had an idea on that, and I may be totally off base, but I thought, and I didn't look it up. I could have checked the back of this book for references to that name. But I was thinking that he was one of those young guys that was served as one of Hitler's personal drivers, that was brilliant, that Hitler was always bragging on this guy and his creativity and his intelligence, and I thought he was one of them.
Artist. He's got to be an artist, doesn't he?
Yeah.
He said a great artist should find another way to serve their country. And he says we've got to. He had. I read elsewhere that he exempted a whole lot of artists from going to the front or from even serving in combat, because he thought that they had gifts for the nation that. And they might not have been visual artists. They could have been all kinds of artists. They had gifts that shouldn't be, were special. And so you could leave the fighting to those who didn't have any. That sounds kind of terrible.
Yeah.
But a lot of these men, though, you know, like this one, he wanted to. He was, you know, he was obviously very patriotic, and he said he went there, and Hitler said he never knew that he was there at the front. He went as a volunteer.
The last sentence there, Carolyn, where he says, I could have sent him anywhere at all for personal reasons if he hadn't insisted on staying in Vienna. So who did he insist on staying in Vienna to? Was it Hitler personally, himself, you know?
No, I don't think so. I don't think Hitler was involved in it. He said he didn't know anything about it. But he had obviously... Oh yeah, well maybe he was invited to come up into another city in Germany, and he wanted to stay in Vienna. Well, that's where his father was. That's where this older Alfred
Fowler
was. And I just don't. If anybody knows, it'd be nice to find out. I really checked out. I didn't, you know, I checked out what I thoroughly enough on the internet, and I would think I'd find him, but I didn't find anybody. An artist named Roller. So, well, anyway, we went through that pretty carefully.
Okay. We'll just move on to the night of the 24th and 25th of February, 1942. An exemplary officer, a group of merry fellows. The death of Undersecretary of State Hoffman has deeply grieved me. In 1919, I harangued his battalion at Passau. What a marvelous lot of men we had there, blazing patriots. To start with, Hoffman trusted me, and yet at that time I stood for so little. Hoffman was already convinced that it was I who would save Germany. At the time of the Kapp putsch, Hoffman sent a telegram, putting myself under Kapp's orders. What's regiment doing? There were a lot of officers of that sort in Bavaria. Sect got rid of them all. The only ones who were kept were those who never wavered. I know three people who, when they're together, never stop laughing. They're Hoffman, Hitler's friend and photographer. Emon and Goebbels. When Epp joins them, the whole thing becomes a madhouse. As a matter of fact, Epp is not particularly quick. When the others are laughing at the third joke, Epp is beginning to catch on to the first one and starts to let out a huge laugh, which goes on and on. Emon, what a jolly chap he is. Already, when we were at the front, he used to let joy loose amongst us. In my unit, even at the worst times, there was always someone who could find something to say that would make us laugh. I'm very fond of Hoffman. He's a man who always makes fun of me. He's a deadpan humorist, and he never fails to find a victim. Just another little side, a personal side there. Mentioning things like humor at the front.
Yeah. Well, that's. Did you want to say more?
No. I just was. You know, little things like that always strike me in such a positive manner.
Well, you know, Hitler liked. We remarked before how much he liked people who were funny and would make, you know, make him and everybody else laugh and could really come up with a good quip. You know, he liked that very much. And him saying that his group of people at the front, there was always somebody who would say something to make them all laugh. And I thought about that, and I thought how serious they had to be there. I thought, does that fit, you know? And then I thought, I kind of got an image. I could just picture them. You know, they're in this serious life or death situations here, but then somebody is able to say something that's funny, and then they all have a laugh. It doesn't mean they sit down and belly laugh for a half hour, you know. They just get a laugh out of it.
Attention.
And then, yeah, and then it lifts everything up. It lifts the spirit. That's what he's talking about, and he appreciated it so much. And I could see that he's absolutely right there. Now, I've got for the next section, as we're at February 25th, there's a timeline, two of them. The internment of Japanese-American citizens in the western United States begins as fears of invasion increase. You see, that propaganda-wise, I don't know
yes.
if they feared invasion, but they're trying
no.
to tell the people, we're in danger of being invaded, you know, to keep everybody's war fervor up.
That's
and
right.
then the other one is Princess Elizabeth registers for war service in England, you know.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The 26th of February, 1942, midday.
Oh, it's the 26th. See, I've got it. I'm having trouble again with these numbers not appearing, and then I have to think and figure out what they are. So this is the 26th. Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Strengthening the German position, the British proletariat, and the threat of revolution, the three objectives of revolution, paradise on earth, the last somersaults of Christianity. In the last few weeks, I've the feeling that our position has got considerably stronger. The little countries are beginning to look on us as a guarantee of order. They'll approach us all the more when they see that England is tying herself up more closely with Bolshevism. When the masses in England realize their own power, probably they'll make a bloody revolution. One can only hold the masses by habit or else by force. Nothing stops me from thinking that they're keeping on the island as a guard against unexpected circumstances, regiments that would be very useful elsewhere. If the Conservative Party lost the support of the army, the only thing left to it would be to make an alliance with the 9,000 supporters of Mosley. They'd need a Cromwell to save them, a premier who would take everything into his own hands. For lack of this solution, the revolution will sweep away everything. It will be one of National Socialism's merits that it knew how to stop the revolution at the proper moment. It's very nice to see the people arise, but one must be a realist and go further than phrases. Nobody any longer counts the revolutions that have miscarried or that degenerated for lack of being led. I've not forgotten the difficulties I had to overcome in 1933 and 34. Revolution opens a sluice gate, and it's often impossible to curb the masses one has let loose. A revolution has three main objectives. First of all, it's a matter of breaking down the partitions between classes so as to enable every man to rise. Secondly, it's a matter of creating a standard of living such that the poorest will be assured of a decent existence. Finally, it's a matter of acting in such a way that the benefits of civilization become common property. The people who call themselves Democrats blame us for our social policy as if it were a kind of disloyalty. According to them, it imperils the privileges of the owning classes. They regard it as an attack on liberty, for liberty, in their view, is the right of those who have power to continue to exercise it. I understand their reaction very well, but we had no choice. National Socialism is a purely German phenomenon, and we never intended to revolutionize the world. It was enough for us to be given a free hand in Russia and to be offered a few colonies. And the English could still be leading their comfortable little existence. It's obvious that, in the long run, they couldn't have avoided certain social reforms. One can't, in fact, bridge the gap that exists between rich and poor merely with the consolations of religion. I realize, for my own part, that if I were offered the choice between nakedness on this earth with the compensation of supreme happiness in the world beyond and an earthly paradise, I certainly wouldn't choose to sing hallelujahs until the end of time. In virtue of what law, divine or otherwise, should the rich alone have the right to govern? The world is passing at this moment through one of the most important revolutions in human history. We are witnessing the final somersaults of Christianity. It began with the Lutheran Revolution. The revolutionary nature of that rebellion lies in the fact that until then there had been only one authority on both the spiritual and the temporal level, that of the Pope, for it was he who delegated temporal power. Dogma cannot resist the ceaselessly renewed attacks of the spirit of free inquiry. One cannot teach at 10 o'clock in the morning truths which one destroys in the 11 o'clock lesson. What is ruining Christianity today is what once ruined the ancient world. The pantheistic mythology would no longer suit the social conditions of the period. As soon as the idea was introduced that all men were equal before God, that world was bound to collapse. What is tragic for the world at present in gestation is that it is itself exposed to the danger of fixing itself in its turn upon a dogma. If Frederick the Great had lived 50 years longer and had been present as a simple spectator at the evolution of society, he'd have ceaselessly used his baton in sheer anger. Men, fortunately, have had this piece of luck, that life is taken away from them at the moment when they would have an opportunity to take part in the destruction of the values on which they'd built. Wow. Powerful stuff there.
What do you want to say about it?
I really like the initial part of this section where he describes a revolution and what its purpose is, its three purposes, main objectives. He hit the nail on the head about, you know, any study of revolution. If it's has any chance of success, you know, first he says you got to break down the partitions between the classes so that as to enable every man to rise, meaning that the revolution is not going to be strictly for the proletariat or the middle class or the power brokers. It's got to fit everybody. It has to serve each one of them. Then he says it's a matter of creating a standard of living so that even the poorest of us will be assured of a decent existence. That makes sense. And then finally, it's a matter of acting in such a way that the benefits of civilization become common property. And that's the greatest way to keep the masses of the population in line, is to give them a fair shake. So I really did like that part of this section.
Well, you're right, and you described it very well, and I'm sure it helps people to get back and get it, fix it in their minds, because it's a little bit hard to follow if you read all this all at once, you know, you're listening to it. But it keeps society intact. It's not a revolution that's going to tear everything down, destroy. But then the only thing he wants to really tear down is the churches. He does seem to want to do that, but he doesn't want to do that in a violent way either. He wants that to happen gradually.
Yes.
But I think that he, when he's doing this talking, he gets on that subject maybe a little more than he really, during conversation like this, more than it does when he's during the day when it's, you know, thinking about policy and so on. I don't think that's a major thing in his mind. But I loved it where I have this one sentence in the next paragraph after he stops talking about revolution, that national socialism is a purely German phenomenon.
Good for you. That's what I had underlined myself.
Yeah, I had that in big letters here. And, I mean, because he's saying it. People are always debating it, like, but here he's telling us that's how he sees it. And not that he thinks other people can't use it, but he's just saying that it's really designed for Germans.
Yes.
You know, German people. And people who say, oh, that doesn't work. You have to be this or that. Well, it maybe doesn't work for you if you're something else, you know, on whatever you might be. But I think it does work for Germans. It did work for Germans. So that's what he's reminding us of here. And he said, and we never intended to revolutionize the world.
Yes. And that's important. It flies in the face of the Allied propaganda about Germany being out to conquer the world. And it's a good, you've heard them say that it's a good thing that we won that war, or we'd have been, if we hadn't have done this, we hadn't done that, we'd be speaking German today. And Hitler was trying to make the world all under National Socialism, which is total garbage.
That fits. Really. And all under German control, they were going to invade every country that amounted to anything and take over.
Yeah.
And people were going to be speaking German. That's just so stupid.
Yes, and
so far wrong.
Yeah, and one thing that gets me about that, Carolyn, is common sense flies out the window to accept that sort of garbage as reality, because you're talking about a nation the size of the state of Texas with 65 million people or so, and they're saying they're going to conquer the Soviet Union, the United States, they're going to take over the world. How absolutely absurd that notion is.
Right, and then, but then he does say here that he did want to have Russia. He wanted the Allies or England or whatever to give him a free hand in Russia, and then to have a few colonies. That's all they wanted. But they wanted to go east. They wanted to have that land in the east. They weren't interested in going west and taking over anything, really. You know. So he thought that was reasonable, but, of course, nobody looks at it that way today, and certainly the Russians and the people.
Well, they never look at his, what I consider his prime reason for wanting to take Russia, and that was to destroy the cancer of Bolshevism before it destroyed Europe.
That was part of it, but he also wanted land in the east.
Yes,
He wanted lots of land. He wanted a big breadbasket there and a place to settle Germans. He did. I don't think we can deny that. People hold that against him today, but I'm not. I think I've got a clear enough idea that this is what he wanted. And, you know, he wrote like that in that Hitler's second book, which I think is he did write, too. He wrote more about that. And he said, you know, that he loves these open spaces. He was strongly of the opinion that Germany was too crowded, and it couldn't expand like he thought Germans should expand, you know, and increase in population in that small area that they had, and they had to have more territory. And he decided Russia was the place to go because he didn't see that as being that. Valuable to anybody? Or he just thought it was a more primitive place, and that it was acceptable and just seemed like it was the perfect solution that he saw for Germany. And that there you're going to always have a big argument about that. But but he was looking for German viability and so on, which is all people in all countries do. They look after their own country. And what will keep it going, like we already said, it's still the same. He wasn't trying to take over everybody. And I think this is a real important part right here. Then he gets on to the Christianity again.
Yeah, and that one particular paragraph in there that struck me as very strong was when he says what is running Christianity today is what once run the ancient world, the pantheistic mythology. That means the many gods and all would no longer suit the social conditions of the period. And then this profound sentence, as soon as the idea was introduced that all men were equal before God, that world was bound to collapse. And I think he said that because that is a very unnatural state of affairs, all men equal before God, when reality is staring you in the face that there are some races of people that are much more gifted than others. And if you're going to have a stable society, progressive society, healthy society, it's the best that have to be leading. And, you know, that's where I took that.
Well, I like that one, too, and I remarked on this paragraph. And, you know, it's just like he's saying that, to me, he's saying, I guess, the same thing you said, but that Christianity had a totally different idea from the ancient world, and that as it got stronger, it ruined the ancient world. And now he's thinking it's being ruined. In turn, I think he means by science. I don't know what else it would be. He thinks that just as Christianity destroyed the ancient world, which he holds in pretty high esteem, that science, he thinks, is just the advances in knowledge and so on, and how we can understand the world, will do away with Christianity because, you know, for him, what he doesn't like are those dogmas that nobody can really believe in. The more you learn and understand the scientific perspective, because it's just silly, you know.
Correct.
The tales. So that's a pretty good section there.
Very much.
All right, and then the timeline. Now, is the next one on the 26th February evening?
Yes, it is.
Okay, and so now the timeline for the 26th is Vivian Bullwinkle, who was the only survivor of the Banka Island Massacre. That's something the Japanese did. Is captured by them and imprisoned by the Japanese. And I did read about this before, and I guess it's a true story. They were taken. There were some nurses and other British nurses and soldiers, and they made them all go into the ocean or something, and they shot them. The women too, the nurses, and they thought, you know, she was hit, but she didn't die, and she managed to crawl out of there, and she managed to survive somehow. But they caught her, they found her, and then they put her in prison. So that's a big, probably, you know, hate thing against the Japanese. Awful they were. So I don't have any comment on it. What do you? Right. I mean, I guess it happened. I don't know what happened exactly.
Yes. Yeah. You know, but like, I'm skeptical of everything I read about war and the conduct of it by different nations. Very skeptical.
Yeah.
And not to say it didn't happen, but hey, it's always going to be embellished to fire up your own side, to make your own side look like the correct one. So I take that stuff with a grain of salt. And yeah, it may have happened, but in the overall scheme of things, what did it really mean?
Yeah.
But
Something for the newspapers to write about.
Oh, yeah. Keep that war fervor going. The hatred and the demonization and dehumanization of your enemy. 26th of February, 1942, evening. Special guests, Himmler and Sturmbannfuhrer, which means Major, K-U-M-M. Fears for Antonescu, the objectionable King Michael, a corrupt ruling class, Erzberger, trafficker in land, Rhodes, German minorities in the Balkans, importance of the Danube. If something happened to Antonescu, I'd tremble for Romania. Who'd succeed him? King Michael. He didn't even help his mother to get down from her carriage. Did he think it would injure his royal dignity? I saw he was choked with rage when he noticed I'd put his mother on my right, the place due to the king. I know very well it wasn't according to protocol, but one can't go on maintaining these obsolete customs. The Romanian peasantry are merely wretched cattle. As for the ruling class, it's rotten to the marrow. In the film, Stat Anatol, those Balkan regions, turned upside down by black gold, are admirably rendered. These people, for whom chance has suddenly put a petroleum well under their feet, and who all at once become fabulously rich, it's contrary to the whole natural order. A town like Bucharest grows only as a result of speculation. I was once able to prove Erzberger guilty of illicit dealing, a squalid deal in real estate. As a result of an indiscretion, he had learnt of a development scheme between Pankow and Berlin. In association with a Monsignor, he had bought for 100,000 marks or so some land that was later sold for 3,700,000 marks. That's why we inserted in the party program a clause concerning speculation in real estate. I don't object to legitimate landowners making a small profit on such occasions, but one must discourage these usurers' enterprises.
Hey, you know, I looked up Erzberger to find out who he was, and boy, I can see that Hitler would have disliked him quite a bit. His first name was Matthias, Matt, uh-huh. Kind of a form of Matt Erzberger. He was from down south there. I don't have it here, but I think he was from around Stuttgart, and he was Reich Minister of Finance from 1919 to 1920. That's just a year, but the First War, and he spoke out against World War I from 1917, and as authorized representative of the Reich government at that time, signed the armistice between Germany and the Allies. Ooh, not good. And he turned into a very fat, he was a very fat youth, but then he managed to lose weight. He was still a chubby-looking guy, but he wasn't obese anymore. But anyway, he was one of those people that they consider, one of the traitors, obviously.
Yes, yes, uh-huh.
And then he's talking about how he was able to prove he was guilty of this land scam, making all that money through, I guess you'd say, insider knowledge or something.
Yeah.
So, there you go.
Okay. For the construction of Autobahnen, I've made a law by the terms of which the indemnities due to the expropriated persons are fixed by the state. And that what he's talking about there is in the United States what we'd call the about some kind of domain, eminent domain, for the good of the public. People's land can be expropriated to build roads or railroads or whatever, and they're supposed to receive a fair indemnification for it, indemnity for it. And that's what he's talking about there for the construction of Autobahn, and he's made a law by the terms of which the indemnities due to the expropriated persons are fixed by the state. And that's just, I think it's to keep fairness in the dealing.
Yeah. Hopefully they did, right.
Yeah. All strategic roads were built by tyrants, for the Romans, the Prussians, or the French. They go straight across the country. The other roads wind like processions and waste everybody's time. The people loves to be ruled. That's why it's sensitive to the loss of certain chiefs. We saw it when Tote died. The sorrow was universal. The people loves to have the best man in command. I'm in favor of our building roads everywhere, but it's not essential always to proceed in a uniform manner. The landscape of Flanders doesn't call for roads like ours. These regions should each keep its own character. Let's not kill the picturesque in the world. The Hungarians are better governed than the Romanians. What a pity they can't install Croats instead of Romanians. The Hungarians are wildly nationalist. They assimilate the Germans at extraordinary speed, and they know how to select the best of them for posts of command. We shan't succeed in preserving the German minorities in Hungary except by taking over control of the state, or else we shall have to withdraw our minorities from Hungary. Apart from those in Transylvania, go ahead.
Oh, I just had this sentence here, but I failed to put it in red, so I was trying to. I just said they were expelled in the end, minorities,
that's right.
From Hungary and a whole lot of all the other places.
Mm-hmm.
But he's recognizing. I think he's recognizing something here that they can't preserve them there unless they control the state, and if they don't, then they're going to have to take the minorities out, their own people, you know, to protect them. That's interesting. Was interesting to me.
Oh yeah, me too. Apart from those in Transylvania, the German minorities in Hungary have a tendency to degenerate. I realized this at Nuremberg when I saw their delegations march past. In our plans for colonization in Russia, we'll find room for these minorities. It's not profitable for us to repatriate minorities, but if I settle them on territories that don't cost me anything, that's quite different. A government must have a lot of authority to succeed in such an operation. Anyway, I suppose that if we want to practice a sincere friendship with Hungary, we shall have to withdraw our minorities from the country. Obviously, if we want to convert the Danube into a German river, our policy will have to be different. In that case, we'd have to settle all our minorities from the Balkans on the banks of the river. But we would be obliged to give the Germans of the Banat, for example, a land as fertile as the Banat. It's clear that the Hungarians and Romanians will never be reconciled, even if they regard Germany as a common enemy. If I settle the 1,500,000 Germans of our minorities in the eastern territories, I'll build an autobahn 1,500 kilometers long, dotted at intervals of 50 to 100 kilometers with German agglomerations, including some important towns. That's a tentative solution, but the Danube remains the Danube. We should establish a strong foothold at the Iron Gates. Unfortunately, it's an unprepossessing region and won't attract our colonists. It will always be possible to populate the region by the exploitation of the copper mines. That will be an excellent way of procuring the copper we need, and there will be all the more reason for it if we're not on good terms with the Yugoslavs. The Danube is also the link with Turkey, and it's only when one's lines of communication are safe that one can build a world empire. So that little section there, Carolyn, the biggest thing that came to me as I read it was Balkanization and so many different people existing in confined areas, and it can't work. You got minorities in this nation feeling like that they are being discriminated against or their rights are not the same as the majority. And so there's always going to be unrest there, and that's that is what the process of is being done to the United States and for the last 50 years anyway, to balkanize us and to disunify us. And I, you know, when I, as I read about this, and he says we're going to have to take our Germans out of there, from out of Hungary, you know, because it's a situation that just cannot exist because it's unnatural.
Yeah, but he says that Hungary and Germany were on very good terms at that time.
Uh-huh.
Hungary was a good friend, and so he saw Hungary as continuing, remaining, and they would not want to have all those Germans there. So, there were Germans throughout that whole area though that had been there since that's where my family was, but. Not at this time. They had left, but there were still some that I wouldn't know about that were still there. They didn't all leave for the United States, but at this time they were going to suffer badly. Boy, did they! You know, my grandparents were very smart to get out to do what they did and when they did. They avoided World War One and World War Two there, and all of that terrible time for the Germans that were in those eastern territories. But I was going to say that Hitler's plan was to move them into this Russian territory. And he wanted to settle a lot of Germans there, as he's describing.
Exactly.
He was going to build a big roads and build towns along there, and some of them would be very, you know, important towns and blah, blah, all that. He had huge plans for that. But I'll just also say that where he says a world empire, the last sentence, only when your lines of communication are safe that you can build a world empire. I added class in there because I think it's more correct to think of it as world class empire, because he wasn't, what he meant was he wanted Germany to be, at a world class level, you might say, or something like that. You know,
yeah.
It doesn't mean to have an empire taking in the whole world.
Right, right. I took it to mean a cooperative in the sense of trade, fair trade with each other, and cooperation and things like that too, and not that world Nazi empire that we hear so much about.
Yeah, and you know, it's true that he was fully aware that these countries, England, Britain, and the USA, and France too, and then the Soviet Union joined in, but it was really the ones in the West that started. They didn't want Germany to be at that level. They wanted to keep Germany down. And intent to bring Germany up to that level, and that would be a world-class empire. They all had empires then. They had colonies,
sure.
You know,
yep.
And which added, they were in charge of lots of territories outside of their home countries there, and particularly Britain. So, that's all. He just wanted to joined the club, I guess, you know, in a sense. He didn't want to take over everything. But that's what they forced him into practically doing. Well,
sure.
Anything more you want to say on that?
Just one thing where he says about the Danube, speaking of it, and he says, we should establish a strong foothold at the Iron Gates. And that is a geographical area of... the border in between Serbia and Romania, and I saw some pictures of it. It's really an impressive looking thing on the Danube River. It's like, for lack of a better comparison, people who occasionally like to take that wild boat ride down the Colorado out west and all, and you see the sides of the canyon going up. It's not quite that dramatic as far as high up, but it's an impressive looking area, and it would be very easy to defend as far as any shipping up and down that river or things like this. And so, anyway, it's just a geographical location. If you look up the Iron Gates, it'll say of Romania or of the Danube. And it's some interesting pictures of that.
Okay, yeah, you know, I looked up the Iron Gates quite a long time ago, and I don't remember now. I'm glad you talked about it because I don't really remember much about it. But it's important.
Yeah, a geographical location on the Danube, and a key. A place to hold on to in the event of troubled times.
Yeah.
Okay, moving on to the night of the 26th and 27th of February 1942. Relief in Russia, the fate of Napoleon. GHQ Wolfschanze, death blow to the petit bourgeois ideal. Sunday will be the 1st March. Boys, you can't imagine what that means to me, how much the last 3 months have worn out my strength, tested my nervous resistance. I can tell you now that during the first 2 weeks of December, we lost 1,000 tanks and had 2,000 locomotives out of operation. As a result of the general lack of material, I seemed to be a liar, and yet I wasn't lying. I told the front that trains were arriving, but the locomotives were always broken down. I told the front that tanks were arriving, but they arrived in what a state. Now, when I send something to the southern sector, I know that it will reach its destination. We have nothing more to fear from climactic mishaps. Now that January and February are past, our enemies can give up the hope of our suffering the fate of Napoleon. They've lost nothing by waiting. Now we're about to switch over to squaring the account. What a relief. I've noticed on the occasion of such events that when everybody loses his nerves, I'm the only one who keeps calm. It was the same thing at the time of the struggle for power, but at that time I had the luck to be only 30, whilst my opponents were 20 or 30 years older. Here in the Wolfschanze, I feel like a prisoner in these dugouts, and my spirit can't escape. In my youth, I dreamed constantly of vast spaces, and life has enabled me to give the dream reality. Ah, if we were at least in Berlin. Space lends wings to my imagination. Often I go at night to the card room, and there I pace to and fro. In that way, I get ideas. My finest headquarters, when all is said, was Felsenest. At the Wolfschlucht, the place wasn't very safe, and I had constant eye ache because of the caustic emanations given off by the fireproofed wood of which the barracks had been built. The third of our headquarters was quite simple, but very agreeable. Unfortunately, it was so damp there that we'd all have ended by falling sick if we stayed there. The fourth, which was intended to be our genuine headquarters, I saw only in a photograph. They made exactly what I didn't want, a castle, and that's the main reason why I refused to settle there. When peace has returned, I'll begin by spending 3 months without doing anything. Our soldiers themselves should have a holiday. I'll immediately resign the command of the Wehrmacht. I'll at once send for Speer again. All our wartime administrative services will be reduced to their simplest terms. Even the four-year plan will be reduced to a more modest scope of activity. I'll pass it over to the Ministry of Economics, by the way. What counts is to organize the work properly and to see that everywhere we have the right man in the right place, and in this, in parentheses, English expression in the original. I'll be glad to know that the petit bourgeois ideal of a nation squeezed between the Elbe and the Weser is receiving its death blow. A new youth is there, avid to make the world's acquaintance, ready to carry on.
Well, you know, just here at the end, the Elbe and the Weser, I looked that up, that area, and I read about it, and I looked at maps, and I don't know what he means, what he's saying about it, what there is about it, that... why this is particularly a petite bourgeois ideal, where a new youth is there. What did you take from that?
Well, I took it as this petite bourgeois seeing Germany as a nation squeezed between the Elbe and the Weser. You know, just that idea receiving its death blow. That this was going to be those borders will never fit our country or whatever.
Yeah, well, but that's not all Germany in there, but anyway.
Yeah.
Again, there's that thing, Germany needs to be able to expand. I guess you could at least say that. That's what he's expressing there. And, I see this as, he mentions in the beginning that it's soon going to be March, and he admits that he was really stressed out over this and had, yes, you know, concerned about this winter. Starting would have been certainly December and January and February, but now he thinks the weather's going to improve, and now he's perking up, and he's even got all kinds of ideas, what, you know, like you do when you've been through kind of a slow spell, and then you're ready to go again.
Right.
And he's hoping for things to turn around. Now they're going to really show what they can.
Military can go on the offensive again.
Yeah, yeah. It's too bad, you know. It should have happened, actually, but things didn't go that well because the Russians also, what did you say? They regrouped themselves, or they figured out some good moves to make. So.
That's true.
It was, and then in the spring you get the mud, too. And
oh, yeah.
I know people said who were in the war said, well, it was better when the ground was frozen than when
correct.
It thawed out. But both, even for the planes, the pilots, because I'm thinking of Leopold Wenger saying that they couldn't even take off, you know, everything got so muddy, because they didn't have paved airports. They were parked in fields. The certain amount of cold, freezing the ground in Russia was good. But when it got so cold, you know, then it froze everything up. So you had to have it just right, and Hitler's doesn't seem to be thinking about the mud right here. But that did come up and was a big problem. As it said, in a country like Russia, Napoleon discovered it. You know, countries like that are backward and don't have good roads or good this or that, you know, good facilities. That's a great protection for them when it comes
is.
To war.
That's exactly right.
Right. So they know how to move about in it, and they build their things for it, you know, to fit. And the Germans didn't quite were catching on, but in the beginning, I think a lot of what they had wasn't suited as well as it could have been for the Russian landscape, because they hadn't really discovered it yet. So, yeah, that's what saved Russia, I think. That's what saved them, was all that mud and cold and crap like that. You know?
That's right.
Yeah, the primitiveness. All right, well, timeline, 27th of February. I hope that's where we're at.
That's where it is, huh?
Okay. We have the Battle of the Java Sea, and under a Dutch admiral, the combined forces lose one aircraft tender, the USS Langley, and six destroyers and five cruisers off Java. So this was the Battle of the Java Sea on the 27th, fought under a Dutch admiral. Well, I will just say one last thing here. You know, speaking about those parentheses, this is the second parentheses tonight, and they're both, I think, have to be, they're both from the translator, you know.
Yeah.
And the translator's telling us that supposedly Hitler said in English, the right man in the right place. That's what he's saying, English expression in the original.
Yeah.
That they use that expression, that's kind of interesting, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
But anyway, these are translated notes.
Okay, right. Moving on to 27th of February, 1942, midday. Laws, man-made and natural. God and the religions. Force and torture impose belief. The true religion. Truth will triumph. Towards a new conception of the world. I believe that Providence gives the victory to the man who knows how to use the brains nature has given him. The notions of law invented by the jurists have little to do with natural laws. The wisdom of nations sometimes expresses truths as old as the world that perfectly reproduce nature's intentions. God helps him who helps himself. It's obvious that man forgets his own destiny. One day I explained to Eltz that what is conventionally called creation is probably an immovable thing, that only man's conception of it is subject to variations. Why doesn't God give everybody the possibility of understanding truth? Every man of average culture knows that at this precise moment, the Catholic religion is of interest to just one-tenth of the population of the globe. He's astonished, too, that Providence, which has willed all that, can allow so many religions, all true from the point of view of those who practice them, to compete for the faith of the faithful. He knows, too, thanks to the view and depth that history enables him to take, that the Christian religion interests only those living in a tiny period of the life of mankind. God made men, but thanks to original sin, we are men in the image of our world, earning our bread in the sweat of our brow. For 500,000 years, God impassively contemplated the spectacle of which he is the author. Then one day he decided to send up on earth his only son. You remember the details of that complicated story. Those who don't believe should, it seems, have faith imposed on them by force. If God is truly interested in men being enlightened, one wonders why he resorts to torture for that purpose. While we're on the subject, let's add that even amongst those who claim to be good Catholics, very few really believe in this humbug. Only old women who have given up everything because life is already withdrawn from them go regularly to church. All that's dead wood, and one shouldn't waste one's time concerning oneself with such brains. In the trade union formed by the church, many of the members have tangible interests to defend and see no further. A given set of grimaces, certain people identify them with true religion. After that, let's express surprise that these cynical exploiters of God are the true purveyors of atheism. Why should men fight to make their point of view triumph if prayer should be enough? In the Spanish struggle, the clergy should have said, "We defend ourselves by the power of prayer," but they deemed it safer to finance a lot of heathens so that Holy Church could save her skin. If I'm a poor devil and die without having had time to repent, I'm all right. But if, as a preliminary, I can dispose of 10 marks to the church's benefit, my affairs appear in a more favorable light. And is that what God would have wanted? That little country girls and simple working men should be set dancing to that tune. That's a thing that can be explained. But that intelligent men should make themselves accomplices to such superstitions, and that it's because of these superstitions and in the name of love that hundreds of thousands of human beings have been exterminated in the course of history, that is something I cannot admit. I shall never believe that what is founded on lies can endure forever. I believe in truth. I'm sure that in the long run, truth must be victorious. It's probable that, as regards religion, we are about to enter an era of tolerance. Everybody will be allowed to seek his own salvation in the way that suits him best. The ancient world knew this climate of tolerance. Nobody took to proselytizing. If I enter a church, it's not with the idea of overturning idols. It's to look for and perhaps find beauties in which I'm interested. It would always be disagreeable for me to go down to posterity as a man who made concessions in this field. I realize that man, in his imperfection, can commit innumerable errors, but to devote myself deliberately to error, that is something I cannot do. I shall never come personally to terms with the Christian lie. In acting as I do, I'm very far from the wish to scandalize, but I rebel when I see the very idea of providence flouted in this fashion. It's a great satisfaction for me to feel myself totally foreign to that world, but I shall feel I'm in my proper place if, after my death, I find myself together with people like me on some sort of Olympus. I shall be in the company of the most enlightened spirits of all times. I adopted a definite attitude on the 21st of March, 1933, when I refused to take part in the religious services organized at Potsdam by the two churches for the inauguration of the new Reichstag. I've never concerned myself in the party with learning to which church the men around me belonged or did not belong. But if I were to die today, it would shock me to know that there's a single sky pilot within a radius of 10 kilometers around me. The idea that one of these fellows could bring me the slightest help would by itself make me despair of Providence. As far as I'm concerned, I act according to my convictions. I don't prevent anyone from praying silently, but I rebel against all blasphemy. So let nobody waste prayers on me that I shall not have asked for. If my presence on earth is providential, I owe it to a superior will. But I owe nothing to the church that traffics in the salvation of souls, and I find it really too cruel. I admit that one cannot impose one's will by force, but I have a horror of people who enjoy inflicting sufferings on other bodies, others' bodies, and tyranny upon others' souls. Our epoch will certainly see the end of the disease of Christianity. It will last another 100 years, 200 years perhaps. My regret will have been that I couldn't, like whoever the prophet was, behold the promised land from afar. We are entering into a conception of the world that will be a sunny era, an era of tolerance. Man must be put in a position to develop freely the talents that God has given him. What is important above all is that we should prevent a greater lie from replacing the lie that is disappearing. The world of Judeo-Bolshevism must collapse.
Wow, that was quite a speech.
I like it.
Well, he made himself as clear as a bell.
That's exactly right.
He went on quite a time there, and
yep.
Everybody was just listening. You go ahead first, Ray.
Well, no, I just, like I said before, when I read this stuff concerning this subject, it's a breath of fresh air for me. It's kind of like a vindication and kind of like, hey, you know, I'm glad to know kindred spirits existed, and it makes me feel good. It's a positive thing to me because he takes on the taboos. Things that are not supposed to be mentioned or discussed, and brings out the weaknesses of all of this imposed religion on people, and the hypocrisy of tolerance, supposed to be brotherhood and tolerance, when if you don't accept our religion, well, we're going to slaughter you. Anyway, I just enjoy it because of that very thing. It's honest and it's straightforward.
There's two things in this part that's very well known of things that upset Christians that are in this that insist that he couldn't have said these things. And one was when he said the lie of Christianity, and the other one was the disease of Christianity. No, the Christian lie was the first one, and then the disease of Christianity came toward the end here. And it's a very, you know, when you just take it out of context and just say, oh, Hitler said this about it and he said that, then
yes.
It sounds pretty terrible, you know, and you think, oh, did he really? Wow, it sounds kind of hateful and so on, and if the Christians get all upset. But really, he was always attacking church Christianity. And there's a lot of elements within Christianity that he would agree with, or he's not maybe as dogma, but, you know, that or he might not think that he saw them in the church people very well, or that the Christians didn't express them very well. But at least they're there, you know, and that he would agree with, you know. And he certainly was a kind-hearted person, except when he was dealing with enemies, and he knew he had to be tough when it came to enemies. But otherwise, he was a kind-hearted person, and he was a tolerant person, in the right sense of the word, in the good sense of the word, and he wouldn't be against things like that. But you have to remember, everybody criticizes the churches, and so he did too, you know. But at that time, Christianity really was church Christianity. I mean, people all went to church and they listened to their
ritualism.
Well, and you know, some ritualism can be kind of nice, but if you believe in it, it's it does make claims that you can't really believe in.
Yes.
But you have to just set aside your thinking mind. And I know I knew a lot of Catholics in my family closer to my age, and I'd ask them, well, how do you believe that? And they'd just say, well, I'd only talk to a couple that way, but said, well, you know, can't believe it, but you just ignore it. You just let it go, you know, you don't argue with it. Because they wanted to stay a part of their church and community and so on. And they know better. They don't believe all that stuff. But they like the church and they like the ritual and they like the mass and all that. I had one cousin when he was really complaining in the 60s when their church went to an English mass, English language. He thought he was saying it just ruined it. He liked the Latin mass. See, it just has a certain element of mystery and so on that it's satisfying to people. Anyway, enough of that. I thought it was funny. He called them a sky pilot. I guess he was talking about the clergy, right?
Yes, that's right.
Sky pilot. Oh, this guy. He's funny. And then he says in the end, you know, that what's worse than Christianity is Judeo-Bolshevism. He does let us know that. Because he said we don't want to get rid of Christianity and then let something worse take its place, which would be Judeo-Bolshevism. And that's the truth, too. And I've always argued that there's a lot about Christianity that holds away pro-Semitism. But less and less today, you know, the church won't, Christian church won't stand against anything today. It goes along with it. It's become Judeo-Bolshevik.
That's right.
So, we've got 15 minutes, Ray. Do you want to go ahead and read the next section?
Sure.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, all right. I think we got plenty of time to cover it.
Okay. All righty.
All righty. 27th of February, 1942, evening. A governor for Belgium, the Dutch and Germanic solidarity, dislike of monarchs, a second French government, slogans for the British. In Holland, Denmark, and Norway, there are movements whose leaders have preferred to nourish an ambition to be one day, thanks to us, presidents of the council, rather than to be, without us, merely retired mayors or something similar. I need a man for Belgium. The difficulty is to choose the man. No question of sending there a North German, somebody brutal, a martinet. I need an extraordinarily clever man, as supple as an eel, amiable, and at the same time, thick-skinned and tough. For Holland, I have one in Sice Incourt, a man who has these qualities. I must surrender to the evidence that I'm again going to have to fall back upon my Austrian compatriots. When I try to decide who amongst my Gauleiters would carry enough guns, I always come back to Yuri. He's clever, intelligent, conciliatory, but intractable in the essential things. My Gauleiter from Styria would be perfect too, but he's a little young. How would it be to send men like Seiss and Yuri to Russia? It would be better to send bulls, but one mustn't confuse suppleness and weakness, and both of them would cut a good figure there. Chirac has done his job very well, and he's now in the running for any important task. Seiss has succeeded in encouraging in Holland a movement that is numbering more and more adherents, and is waging war against Wilhelmina without our having to put a shoulder to the wheel. The idea of Germanic solidarity is making more and more impression on the minds of the Dutch. As regard the monarchs, the worst nuisances are those who've grown old in harness. They become, in a sort of way, taboo. You scarcely touch them, and everybody begins to howl. Franz Joseph, for example, was much less intelligent than his successor, but a revolution against him was not possible. What a lot of affronts he swallowed in the course of his interminable life. Finally, he acquired the style of a Buddha. For more than a half a century, he witnessed events without reacting to them. If the Dane goes about it like the old Swede, who does nothing but gather his strength by playing tennis, he'll reach the age of Methuselah. Gustav V, or the fifth, was telling me that he had an excellent constitution, for if his absence from the country lasted more than 4 weeks, he had to be replaced. It's by dint of doing nothing that these puppets become impudently old. In Denmark, we already have the successor. That's Clausen. When we've reached that point, we'll have three men who will have sinned so much that they'll be obliged to remain allied to us whatever happens. We can count on Clausen, and likewise on Mussert. In Belgium, there's this damn king. If only he had cleared out like the others, I'd have allowed his pretty girlfriend to go and join him. In Paris, we'll probably have a second French government. Abetz is too exclusively keen on collaboration to my taste. Unfortunately, I can't tell him precisely what my objects are, for he has a wife. The fact is, I know of a man who talks in his sleep, and I sometimes wonder whether Abetz doesn't do the same. But he's intelligent at organizing resistance in Paris against Vichy, and in this respect, his wife is useful to him. Thus, things take on a more innocent character. If we succeed in forming a second French government in Paris, the opposition in Vichy would have only one wish, that we would stay, for fear that it should be discovered how many of them are paid by us. My opinion is that the longer we stay in Paris, the better worthwhile it will be. In any case, I shall never have any difficulty in finding occupants for Paris. And there's no risk that one day a unit of the Wehrmacht may mutiny, saying, "We don't want to stay in France anymore." I've explained to Himmler that if I'd been an emperor of the Holy Empire, I'd have put him in disgrace. I very well understand the emperors who were not tempted by the conquest of the East. These spaces had no roads and no means of heating. Winter there lasted all the year round. It's easy to say blood and soil, but for the particularism of the German princes, we'd have succeeded in Germanizing the whole of northern Italy. Racially, the West is to a great extent Germanic. Himmler's theory needs serious consideration. We pay far too much honor to Heinrich the Lion, for he helped in frustrating the policy of Barbarossa and Heinrich VI. If everyone had supported the emperor's policy, what would we not have achieved? Supposing the expansion to the west had been pursued logically, we'd have a great Germanic empire stretching from Denmark to the Loire, and England would not have acquired the importance that is hers today. The moment has come when propaganda can play an important role in our favor. It's not a matter of attacking each Englishman individually to induce him to such and such a particular action. It's a matter of propaganda that sets forth undeniable facts, and consequently, slogans that fall upon a soil well prepared to receive them. For example, the British Empire is becoming more and more a colony of American Jews. On the organ of Westminster Abbey, the Internationale was played after the service. What can that mean, if not the fall of Christianity? It's enough to compare the statements now being made in London with those issuing a year ago from Lisbon to realize the change in the situation. It's a turning point in history.
Wow, that's complex.
Yes, it is, very.
Do you have some commenting on it?
I took it to mean the problems they're going to have governing these territories and all, and overcoming the enemies within those places, and putting the right man in the right place there, and the lack of cooperation here and there that keep things unsteady in these different places that the Germans are now occupying. And then he talks about the missed opportunities back in the past that kept a Germanic unity, where he says racially the West is to a great extent Germanic, and you know, if everyone had supported the Emperor's policy, what would we not have achieved? You know, he said, we'd have a great Germanic empire stretching from Denmark to the Loire, and England
Loire,
would not have
the Loire.
Loire, the river, yeah. And would not have acquired the importance that is hers today. So, yeah, you're right. It's quite a complex bit of statements in here.
Yeah, you have to be familiar with it. Now, what was going on in France? Between the Vichy and the Paris, and they were occupying Paris. What does he say we have to have a second French government in Paris?
Well, because the Vichy regime was very pro-German.
Yeah.
And they were detested by the nationalistic French around the capital. And, you know, they would do everything they could to frustrate things over there. And I think what he's talking about is we need a new French government was the one that was very anti-Vichy. You know, some people needed to be replaced there or whatever with a new attitude, maybe one of more of appreciation for what Germany had done for them, keeping their nation from falling to the eventual goals of the USSR, whatever, you know. But I don't know, that's kind of the way I see it.
Well, I'm going to have to do some reading up on occupied France in World War II, because I am a bit confused about it. Sometimes, you know, I read about this and I realize I don't know enough to understand what's going on there. The Internationale was played after the service at Westminster Abbey. What Internationale? The French Internationale?
No, I took that to mean strictly the Soviet, meaning the communist anthem.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah, that's why it says, what can that mean if not the fall of Christianity?
Yes. And you, I mean, you have communism, which is supposed to be atheistic or very anti-Christian, and it is because it's Jewish-run, but you've got that played on the church organ, you know, the Communist Internationale, so that's why he says that.
Oh, that's interesting. I'm going to have to study a little bit up on this last section. I might have a few things to say about it next week. I don't know. But anyway, Ray, I think we're done for tonight.
Yeah.
Right? So if you have any more comments, you go right ahead and then take us out, if you would, please.
All right. Well, just that, the show started with Carolyn saying we have some pretty interesting topics to cover tonight, and some fascinating things to discuss. It proved to be true. Same thing will be true with our next section. So we appreciate everybody that listened tonight and joined us, and we ask that you come back and see us next week.